could do too, which is this sort of this process of beginning to understand based on the dynamic of play. Where that sort of gets a little bit more complicated, as usual, is where humans come in, and that is in that we now we do all the animal processes of play, which are these sort of more physical tumblings and kind of pokings at each other to sort of understand what the limits of our expressibility are and the limits of sort of social interaction are. But then what we do beyond that is we begin to formalize, because we have something called language. And it turns out that language is something that goes a lot, like, much huger than sort of the grammars and vocabularies and things that were taught in school books about, you know, what does it mean to speak? What does it mean to express yourself? These things can, you know, these things often are cataloged as, you know, lists of words and, you know, grammars of noun and verb conjugation, things like that. But above and beyond that is a whole grammar of interaction that we have with each other that we've developed through play. We have certain affordances with each other and with our society because we've goofed off, and that goofing off has given us sort of an understanding of what the limits and what the thresholds are. But then, beyond that, we have artifacts that we begin to play. We bring models into the world, which is really what makes us different as organisms, is that we have the ability to model ourselves, we have the ability to model each other, and we have the ability to model abstract systems. Now, abstract systems, I think, are probably going to become, through game design, which is what, you know, sort of this growing medium that's gathering a lot of momentum in the way that sort of media is defining itself and the way that we experience the world. Game design is now sort of providing for culture this really accessible way of understanding what we mean by dynamic system models. But what we do already on a very low level is form for ourselves dynamic system models about the world. One of the first ways that we do that is in formalizing games. Here we have an example of hopscotch. I don't know if that's a popular game in Denmark as well, but in the U.S. it's something that's played on a school playground. And the thing that's most important about it is that it has no artifacts other than cultural consensus. I mean, you need something that you can scratch on the ground with, but the making of those boxes that you put on the ground are basically a ritualized kind of outpouring of something that starts in the social. It's something that we all can approach these boxes, and they infer a set of rules. And the rules are really what the important thing is. The rules are the model. And the model is something that provides a shape to our actions. It's something that gives us a space to fill with a vocabulary of the instance of play, with an instance of our action within a set of rules, which is what play is, in a formalized sense, a game. So the thing that makes it interesting, we have a set of rules, which, you know, a set of rules read just by themselves are a book. They're a linear sort of list of terms that are dead because they have no, they're just a frame that has no content, to use the C word. It turns out that what the content is in this case is our own actions. What we've done is provided merely a framework, which is just a box that we've drawn on the ground, that the important thing that's going to take place in that, and that once we've sort of ritually opened up the space of play, is the improvisational act of play, which is the moment where the instance of traveling through the rule set as a group or by oneself, and that instance is unique. It's something that happens only once because it's a combination of one's will at the moment in the given space and time within the context of the rule set. And that uniqueness is what we find compelling because that uniqueness represents complexity. And complexity is something that we are ourselves complex creatures, and we also seek the complex as a place to have discourse and dialogue, because that's, if things are too orderly, we become bored, and if things are too random, we fail to project patterns into them, we don't understand them, and we walk away. So the next thing that's really interesting about games is that they serve as both a place to store metaphors that we've learned about the world, and also a place to enact metaphors that we understand about the world, or a source by which we can project those metaphors onto the world. So chess, one of two probably most, I mean, in the West, it's definitely the most sort of it's the largest source of metaphoric material, I would say, in the game space. I think Go, ultimately, is a larger space for metaphoric material, but it's not as well known in the West. But anyway, chess, obviously, you know, it's a game about feudalism. You know, it has an actual metaphor that is historically situated. You know, we can look at these pieces, and we've seen each of the way, these pieces exist outside of the game. I mean, they are entities that are from history, and by codifying their behavior in a game, we make a statement about the people that sort of throughout history codify the rules of chess are making a statement about the function of medieval society, because all of the pieces here, in their different behaviors, there's an implied power by the fact that the queen can move faster than the king. There is, you know, a rigidity to the way that the bishop moved in diagonals. All of these things are sort of speaking about the world through the model of a game. So there is already this understanding that literacy in the model of this game transfers to literacy about the world based on the metaphors. And so what you find is that there's just a bazillion places in literature and popular culture where chess is used as a metaphoric source, because people have internalized this model, so they understand the inferences of the power relationships of the pieces. And so you can title things like All the King's Men, or things like, you know, various titles that show up in culture, or just references that show up in culture that actually point to the sort of metaphoric relationships that come from chess. So already games are functioning as this, as both a place to store cultural knowledge and a place to sort of withdraw that knowledge and project it back onto other instances of communication. Then stacked on top of sort of reference is this idea of interpretation. The fact that you can reference the king and the queen is one thing, but then when you play through a game and it begins to have a symbological vocabulary that has countless inferences and complexities, then you end up with something rich enough to be called a language in its own right. If you have a set of entities in the game, and by looking at the state of the game at any one moment, you can make forecasts and prognostications and warnings and sort of have feelings about the state of the game, then you've entered a symbolic territory, and the symbolism becomes really powerful, and you can use that to sort of describe things beyond sort of the denotative. You can describe connotative things, you can describe emotional things, you can describe artistic things. And that's interesting to see in the evolution of something like Tarot, which was initially used as a formal deck of cards for regular gameplay, and over the years, because of its reappropriation, its sampling as a way of expressiveness, people started to understand the metaphors about the game more than they understood the game itself. And so the games sort of fell away into the background, and what was left was a system for expressing possibilities, expressing sort of emotional states and states of, you know, fortune telling. So one of the things that's really interesting about what's happening now with the way that play is evolving as kind of an element in the culture is that there are multiple states of play. There are multiple sort of levels of engagement with play that we all go through, especially when playing games like on console games, like racing games, or, you know, skiing games or things like that, or also massively multiplayer games where we're going online and participating with a whole bunch of other players. What we've come up against is this idea that you have multiple modes. When you're starting up a game like a racing game, the first thing you do is not go out to the track and immediately begin, you know, speeding around. What you do is you're given a screen where you make choices about the attributes that are available on the vehicle that you're going to drive. Now, what this is, this screen is a compositional screen. It's similar to the part of the production of music where you write a score. What you're doing is filling up. So in any medium or in any sort of space of play, there is a very broad kind of sort of volume of possibilities that anybody could, you know, you as an active play inside that volume of possibilities, you can trace, you know, all sorts of different courses. Now, in order to sort of constrain that and to sort of make an instrument for yourself in this wide space of play, you need to sort of configure your vehicle, whether it's a vehicle, the vehicle's a car or a character or whatever it is that is going to sort of propel you through the space of play. You have to configure its variables so that you sort of know the role that you're going to be playing in the larger play space. So there's kind of there are initially you're looking out at the entirety of the possibility space of play and sort of understanding for yourself what your role or what your aspect of approach into that space, you know, looking at the whole rule set, you say, okay, well, I'm approaching it from this angle this time. And then, of course, in correspondence to that, there's the moment that that's actualized, the moment that all of the variables that you've configured and your view into the rule space of the game is actually becomes performative, where you say, okay, I have my vehicle configured, I have my character set up, I sort of understand what it is that I want to do in this game, and then it's the actualization moment where you actually enter the game. The game, you know, you enter sort of the bounded moment where metrics are being accreted and people are sort of keeping track of how well you're doing. And so the space of performance is one of being in an observed environment and being self-conscious of all actions having consequences according to the rule system that you're participating in. So you sort of have these two states that you move back and forth in when you're considering play. You have these you move back out into the space of composition in order to sort of reconfigure your variability and sort of what it is that you want to be doing in the game. And then once you sort of, you know, you've circumnavigated the sort of exterior surface of the space of play, then you plunge back in again and have another experience, which is an instance of play. And one of the things that also is very important, turns out, in the way that we're playing, especially in a massively multiplayer game spaces these days, is this idea of presence. And presence is really just a very basic moment where you understand that you're not alone in a system that you're having experience in. And that's really valuable because we as human creatures are communicative organisms, and so you don't a lot of times want, I mean, it turns out you can play a console game at home, but a lot of times there's now a new kind of sociability that's evolved around that, which is that you're in performance because you have a whole bunch of people sitting around. You know, a lot of times people will play games together socially. One person is actually at the controller. They're manipulating the character. Everyone else is watching, and there's something more valuable to a certain extent to some people for that of that experience. They like the idea that they're part of a social sort of collaborative moment where they're the person at the controls, but then there's also the moment where you hand it over to someone else and they become the person at the controls. And then in the massively multiplayer environment, there's also this idea of presence where people are using the mechanics of the game to communicate to each other in ways that we don't even really understand yet, because we're sort of all of the ways that expression in those spaces can happen are above and beyond the types of language that we've used in face-to-face culture or even on the internet so far. There are a bunch of different ways you can take objects and behaviors and trade them with each other and create new types of meaning and understanding. So the idea of presence actually sort of also is sort of supported in the game by the idea that we model, you know, this is sort of what I was talking about early on when I was talking about play and how it helps us define our world and other people in it, is that we as humans do this thing that now is sort of, you know, showing up in this idea in computer science about artificial intelligence has shown up a long time ago, but I think people have abandoned the idea of trying to recreate, you know, total human artificial intelligence. But there's this idea now that there is a way of creating, for instance, in a game that you're playing against the computer, there is an AI, although a very simple one, that knows the rules of the game that you're playing against, and that thing is a state machine. And what a state machine is something that just is a model of the game or whatever it perceives and the possible actions that it might take against the game or against you as a player. And what's interesting about that is that we all maintain models that are very much like state machines about everyone that we know, everyone that we interact with, and our world. That's sort of how we, you know, proceed through life. This is part of this CogSci 101, to continue some of the learning we had earlier today, is that we're kind of advancing through frames of a state machine in our sort of everyday experience. And now we have this, you know, sort of very concrete entities on the other end of a game that we might be playing that are very much state machines. And so that kind of subconscious learning that we've already done about modeling the other is now something we apply to the artificial intelligences that are on the other end of the game. And the thing that's really interesting about that is what this means is that a lot of times people that are playing very complex games like real-time strategy games, Warcraft and StarCraft and various, you know, games in which lots of entities are moving and relating to each other. Things are being produced and destroyed. There are, you know, fronts and warfare and things like that. But after a while, you know, you talk to a 14-year-old that's playing one of these games, and you talk to them about, you know, orcs and magicians and things like that, and they don't even really need the metaphor anymore after they've been playing for about 3 or 4 weeks. What they've done is internalize a model of the mechanics of the game and an understanding of how the artificial intelligence on the other end of it operates those mechanics and the best way that they can combat that. So they don't, it becomes a very abstract, almost philosophical exercise for them. They just sort of are thinking, well, this is the state of affairs in my world, and this is the state of affairs in the enemy's world, and I'm sort of just moving, you know, sort of this real-time composition of forces that I'm kind of trying to maintain to balance and push against the same composition that's taking place in the mind of the artificial intelligence. And so that conversation is something that's happening on a level of sort of resolution and detail that most of our conversational techniques don't even go there yet. We just don't even really understand what the implications of having that much complexity in our interactions with each other means. So one of the things that now happens in these spaces is part of this augmentation that we have available to us in sort of the game space and the space of play is this idea that we have, well, some of the things that we've been talking about already in this conference, which is the sort of the accretion of data and metadata that we've, you know, that all these things like Flickr and Delicious and sort of the things that are beginning to catalog our lives for us, you know, sort of in this self-organizing way, all of these resources are now sort of becoming available as items, artifacts with which we can play. Now, this is already, you know, an obvious consequence of this is the DJ, the actual scratching and remixing culture, which is a very playful culture. I mean, the very idea behind that process is playfulness. I mean, it's, you know, when you're taking something and, you know, playing with it, it's actually creating something new, and it's an act of creativity that people are now just starting to recognize that play is a creative act. And that's really sort of what the heart of, you know, my project is, someone who's trying to recognize the impact of play in creative applications. You know, how do you get the process of play, how do you get into the state of play in a creative context? And some of the most amazing examples of this are already starting to show up in the game world, particularly in these sort of lightweight and casual games that are showing up on the handheld consoles. This one is from the Nintendo DS, and it's called Electroplankton. It's an amazing little piece of software. It's extremely playful because it's extremely simple, but it's also very creative because it generates music. It's actually a sequencer that is interacted with in a very simple way. There's little creatures that are kind of zooming around in the environment, and as you click on them, they bind to each other and create sequence. They each represent a MIDI note and a tone in a sequence. And as you click on them, they interact with each other. You're sort of corralling them or shepherding them into relationships with each other. And as they relate together, they make more complex chains of music, and you begin to build an actual composition that's based on sort of a playful interaction with these little tiny artificially intelligent creatures that are in the environment. And this is sort of, you know, kind of a baseline type of emergence that could inform creativity through play. So you go from the baseline, you know, to the 50 billion foot view, which is, of course, Will Wright, who I don't know how many people know, but he is I'm sure as we look back on this era historically, he'll be one of the most important people in interaction design. He designed The Sims, he designed SimCity, and he's now designing a game called Spore, which I can't even go into explaining because it's mind blowing. But the point is that his take on simulation has been that it's not a game, it's a toy, which is a really important distinction, because games are goal-oriented. The rules under which they operate are qualitative rules, quantitative rules, in that there is an end state that has a winner and a loser. Whereas in simulation, which is a simulation toy like this one, it's actually more of just a meditative thing that you can learn from in kind of a creative way. And the interesting part about it is its expressivity. I mean, when you're using a simulation, you can actually in its immense variability, you can actually make a statement because you have enough control over the variables and the way the thing plays out that you've left, you can actually see through cause and effect the footprint that you've left in sort of the gigantic, you know, states of possibilities that this, how this thing could play out. But the thing that's also interesting about that is that in simulation, you have this idea that that those sort of AIs that I was talking about earlier, these things that are kind of motivating each of the little creatures in a simulation, there's not just one organism, you know, sort of one top-down artificial intelligence that you're playing against, but instead you're playing with a bottom-up kind of emergent system. These are usually agent-based systems, which mean that there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of entities that are interacting together to build sort of a state machine out of their total interaction. And the thing that's amazing about that is that there are unpredictable results, and that's something that we look for in the way that we're entertained, the way that we investigate the world, is that we like to have things just on the cusp of unpredictability, so that as we poke at them, sometimes we're rewarded in ways that we, you know, sort of expect, and sometimes we're not, and that will sort of draw us into further investigation of the rules of the system, because if we don't understand it, it's going to sort of provoke our inquiry. So, kind of in summation, what we have at our disposal in all of these, you know, sort of new environments, ludic environments that we're building for ourselves, whether they're sort of overtly ludic, you know, as a massively multiplayer game or something along those lines, or just kind of ludic as a byproduct, as, you know, Flickr turned out to be when we initially designed Game Never Ending, we were thinking very much in overtly ludic terms. The whole point was that everyone was going to participate in this online web experience where you know, the point of the game was to actually exchange media objects. There's this sort of, in a lot of these massively multiplayer games, this one on the screen behind me is World of Warcraft, there are these making economies where part of what you're trying to do in the game is become, you know, higher, you have skill sets at making things. And so one of the skill sets that we were going to introduce in Game Never Ending was the idea that as a producer of culture on the web, those were your making skills. So you were actually making blogs, you were making, you know, wiki, you were making photos, you were making all these different things, and that making task is actually part of the metric that you were succeeding in Game Never Ending. So Flickr was actually something that was spawned out as a shard of that sort of totalizing vision of what the process of Game Never Ending was just this one fragment of, like, well, you can make visual representations of your world. And so what's happening in World of Warcraft, for instance, is that they're not, you know, it's not open like Game Never Ending, so it's not about, you know, sort of bringing in arbitrary bits of media, but what they are doing is repurposing the sort of media that they have at their disposal inside the game for interpersonal communication. So one of the things that happens that's really interesting in Game Never Ending is that, I'm sorry, in World of Warcraft, is that a lot of times when people, you know, sort of greet each other as they're moving through this massive world, rather than using language, like to say hello, like, hey, what's up, or using even the sort of emotive character manipulations, like waving at someone, they do something that's totally sort of outside of language that we have available to us now, which is called a power-up. Everyone has these abilities to affect the characteristics of another character, which is to give them, you know, temporarily more strength or more health or something like that. So what happens is someone runs into a room and sees a whole bunch of people they see and just casts a spell on all of them, and they have these little glowing auras and little icons floating above their head for a moment, and that's how they know that someone that their friend has entered the room, is because their abilities have just changed, and so, oh, someone I know is probably around and they've cast this thing on me. Which is not something that we can do to each other here in this room yet. Obviously, you know, the augmentation of reality is bringing a lot of the things from online into our offline experiences of the real world. But what this does point to is this idea that our mechanisms for communication are greatly, greatly enhanced by sort of the possibilities of the ludic space. And I think we're sort of headed towards a new language based on some of what that exposes to us. And I think we're on our way right now, and I think I'm about done.
I will shout in the meantime. Thank you, Ben. We have time for questions right now, so please feel free to start lining up. Come up here.
It seems pretty clear that games sort of approach reality more and more in their modeling, in the rules, in our control through joysticks and any other means. And it often strikes me that, you know, why are we playing games when we have a real world where we have met all the, you know, we are there, we have the total control, we have, everything has infinite properties, we can combine anything. How close do you think games will come to reality before they become irrelevant? Because yeah, obviously we choose between real games and reality.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about that moment. I mean, I think you're right about that, and I think that's actually something that we're headed towards really quickly, because I don't know if people have been following the announcements around the new consoles that Sony and Microsoft are introducing, but they've spent a whole bunch of time and energy improving the ability to render graphics on these systems. I don't think that inherently is going to make for better gameplay, but what it will do is bring around sort of what I call the realism event horizon, which I think is definitely something that you're referring to, and that to me is actually a liberating moment for a medium, because we've pretty much reached that point with a lot of the other media that have become sort of the culturally canonical media, specifically painting. You know, went through a moment where finally, you know, well, the arrival of photography really transformed painting, and that there was a way, you know, it had the task of trying to get closer and closer to one-to-one resolution with reality. And then photography showed up, which had a lot higher resolution towards reality than painting. And so painting was left to do its own thing, which was a really great moment for it. It became abstract, it became expressionist, it was sort of opened up to this, like, a much huger kind of emotional vocabulary and a much huger kind of interpretive vocabulary. And that's actually what I'm waiting for all the Phong shaders and whatever it is to, like, render everything out in this really exquisite way, so that everyone can say, okay, you know, we're done with this realism. You know, what's up with surrealism? And I think that's going to be a great moment for gaming. And I think some things. I mean, Nintendo is already on the surrealistic track. They don't even care about photorealism. I'm a huge fan of Nintendo because I really appreciate what they're doing in that way. Is that almost all of their innovation goes towards interaction innovation. It's not about rendering innovation, because I think they kind of recognize that as a dead end. I mean, you can spend more and more money on faster and faster chips and give more money to Nvidia or whoever it is, you know. But that's not really where the soul of the game is. It's in the interaction.
So what is the surrealism?
Well, surrealist gaming already, you know, it exists in a lot of places where games aren't officially. I mean, that's, I think, the idea of what, you know, the surrealist game is. There are a lot of things that, you know, have shown up even in sort of the philosophy of everyday life. I mean, I think Brian Eno produced this thing a long time ago that was called The Oblique Strategies, which was almost a game, but it's also just a way of approaching creative tasks. But it does bring the ludic kind of, you know, it's a lot of little cards that you sort of play on yourself as you're thinking about creative tasks, and they sort of change your attitude about it. But I would say, you know, I would offer up Flickr in some ways as a surrealist game, in the sense that basically it is a sort of churning possibility space of sudden outbreaks of rule sets. You know, people say, oh, squared circle, which is I don't know if people have played around with Flickr that much, but there are lots of ways where you can sort of, you can bait people into responding to a task or a, categorization or a tag that sort of brings people into the fold of, like, oh, let's see how well we can do at reproducing, you know, the sort of task at hand. And so I think that, you know, surrealist gaming actually just sort of melts into everyday life in kind of a pervasive way.
More questions? Go ahead.
I just wanted to hear your views on the virtual economies and physical economies that have grown up around some of the games and
I think, yeah, that was one of the really interesting things. You know, in designing Game Never Ending, you know, it was going to kind of be in that same space of Second Life and there, and you know, even sort of more formalized EverQuest and Ultima Online and some of these places that have had real economies that have taken place. And I think I am all for it. I mean, I think that the idea that there's a blending or a bleeding between the spaces of the virtual and the real, I mean, I think that's already happening on, you know, in a social way. I mean, that was the other thing that was about, you know, Game Never Ending. When we first implemented it, the only metric that we had in the game at all was sort of this, you know, sort of friendsterized buddy list kind of situation where, except for we had a little bit higher gradient of how people were related to each other, or I should say a higher vocabulary of relationships that you could have with people. It wasn't just friend or not friend, but you could have different, you know, I'm a workmate, I'm a this, I'm a that to someone else. And you could sort of characterize how your social network played out inside the game. But the other thing that was interesting about that is that we didn't actually say whether these relationships you were going to build for yourself inside the game were supposed to stay inside the game or whether they were supposed to point out to the real life, you know, and so people started using, I mean, which is exactly what I was hoping for, is that you sort of used Game Never Ending as this kind of narrativized framework for things outside the game. And in a way, you know, this economy, you know, these virtual economies are narrativized frameworks, you know, for transactions that happen outside the game, you know, and I think there's something a little weird about, you know, this sort of stack of, you know, nothingness on top of nothingness or whatever. You know, money is already such a strange, like, ephemeral thing, and if you're now spending money on things that don't exist, you know, it's like even weirder. And it also sort of plays into the general disquiet I think that a lot of us feel about intellectual property and the ownership of ideas, you know, and that's something that, you know, obviously an economy based on the buying and selling of objects that don't exist is, you know, intellectual property. You know, I have some problems with that, but I also find it's really interesting because it allows people, a lot of times people will participate in these virtual economies and they'll learn a hell of a lot about economics that they don't even know about, you know, as they're wildly wielding their credit card or whatever it is in, like, day-to-day life. They're not thinking about economics, but then when they're a producer, which very few people, I mean, that's a role that a lot of people don't have the chance to play at all in their day-to-day lives, the idea of, you know, being a producer anymore. A lot of times people are just in a service economy or whatever they're doing, and they're consumers. I mean, we're all used to the label of consumers by now, but the idea of having making skills and making something that's consumed by people and being paid for that as an artifact is, like, kind of a, you know, it's a new thing for some people.
Thank you, Ben. Right on time. Lunch is going to be here with it shortly, and I think we have then about an hour to consume that. And after that, back here, Hall A, Jimbo Wales, Wikipedia, and then we'll be splitting out in the different rooms after that. Thank you.